Welcome once again to another fantastic episode of the Business Creators Radio Show. We help business creators like you win at the game of business and marketing so you can thrive from your intersection of your brilliance and your passion and make a difference for your community, market, and audience. Please take a moment and visit our website, www.businesscreatorsradioshow.com. You'll find hundreds of episodes covering a breadth and depth of topics relevant to you as a business creator, and links to subscribe via your favorite network so you get fresh episodes delivered straight to you. And now, here's today's episode. Let's get started.
My name is Adam Homey. I am your host. I am honored once again by your wise decision to tune in.
Check out our previous and upcoming episodes on our website at www.businesscreatorsradioshow.com. While you're there, be sure to subscribe via your favorite network so you get fresh episodes delivered straight to you. Until next time, have a great day.
To your intersection of your brilliance and your passion. I come to you from Las Vegas on the balcony of my sumptuous apartment here in what some call the hottest city in America on some days. As you listen in and tune today, you may occasionally hear some background noises. We're pretty close to the airport. The strip is about 4 miles away, so if they're throwing a concert, that might come through. We're at a point right now where some of the children in the community are enjoying a very pleasant evening outside. So if you hear the jocularity of the children's friendly screeches, just know that we're in the real world. Now, and there's one right now. I'm not sure how my noise cancellation is doing. At any rate, I love the conversations we have here because we get to take this places that most business podcasts do not. When this person came to my notice, when they were introduced to me a few weeks ago, I was struck by a word that they used, intrapreneurship. And then I saw the development of it, how to progress in toxic cultures. Now, I love inventing words that create new meanings, and I believe that might have been what happened here. We'll find out. And having been in toxic cultures before, in fact, I wrote about one in my contribution to Journeys to Success, the Millennial Edition. These are things that are close to my brilliance and my passion. So let's introduce today's guest. His name is Luis Baez. He is a revenue enablement strategist and sales coach dedicated to serving executives and sales leaders at businesses. So he has quite a story that he's going to tell us about. He's worked with some of the big Silicon Valley startups, and there were some lessons there. But today, he's the Global Director of Revenue Enablement at Deputy, which is a SaaS workforce management production company, not to mention a published author through the internationally recognized Mavecraft organization, which includes an incredibly popular LinkedIn learning course on personalized sales that has been taken by over 15,000 people to date. All right, I'm sold already. Luis Baez, come on in. The weather's fine.
Thank you so very much, Adam. I appreciate the opportunity to connect with you and your audience.
I read off part of the official bio, and yeah. I mentioned that I teased a bit of it because I'm going to let you say it in your own words because I think you'll say it better than I can. But what we like to do here before we get into the topic, and we're going to cover entrepreneurship, toxic cultures, and possibly some other topics, depending on where our conversation goes. First, let's pull back the curtain. And tell us in your own words a bit about your journey and what has brought you here today, serving business creators from your intersection of your brilliance and your passion.
Well, I appreciate that. So I am someone who grew up in poverty and did not accept that reality. And I worked really hard as someone who was first generation, an out gay man, Puerto Rican. Uh-huh. I stepped into the corporate world, not really knowing what I was getting myself into, but very confident in my capacity to sell myself. And so I developed a career in corporate sales, starting in advertising sales and on to tech and software sales, as well as luxury vehicle for a quick moment. And I ran, and I had an opportunity to the West Coast from living in New York City all my life, shifted over to Silicon Valley where the moving and the shaking was happening. I ended up being recruited at LinkedIn, Google, Uber, and Tesla, beyond my wildest dreams. And I got to step into enterprise sales, doing multi-million dollar deals. I got to lead a team into multi-million dollar success. And in that vein of wanting to figure out how do I give back, or how do I contribute, or how do I make a bigger impact beyond just my individual contribution, I ended up falling into sales coaching and training and enablement. And in that vein, I also started to think about, well, how can I also leverage everything that I've learned working at these bigger companies and spread that gospel and, you know, help other businesses learn how to operate and be efficient and help other leaders sort of lead with that same servant leader and compassionate leader and authentic leadership sort of examples that I ended up having in my career. And so that's how I ended up down this path. And ultimately at this conversation today, it was really from an intention of taking everything that I've learned and passing it on to the next person.
Wow. So what we want to do first is define our terms. I think that's going to be a great place to start. Entrepreneur, yeah. Entrepreneur.
Yes.
As I mentioned, I love when people create new portmanteaus and create new words with new meanings. I believe that language is a living thing, regardless of which language you speak or languages you speak. And so tell me what an entrepreneur is and why do we need to know this?
Yeah, I can't take credit for the word. I don't know that I was the one that came up with it, but it was certainly something that popped into my mind and led to a Google rabbit hole and then the work that I ended up doing thereafter. But I had an experience where I reached a point in my career where I wasn't really getting what I needed or wanted intellectually from the job that I had at the time. And I started to get taps on my shoulder to help other people and other businesses with the sort of background and experience and knowledge that I had. And I ended up falling into accidental entrepreneurship. And I eventually, when I needed to, stepped away from full-time corporate and stepped into full-time entrepreneurship. And it was when I was in the thick of that experience that I had the aha moment of, you know, I didn't realize how good I had it working in sales all those years. And someone else was taking care of the marketing. Someone else was handling the operations and the overhead, right? I was just focused on the customer and I was walking away with commissions. And it clicked for me that a lot of the skills, ethic, mindset, and everything that I brought into my entrepreneurial experience really came from being an entrepreneur within a company and having worked in sales, having been part of founding sales forces at companies, building new territories, new verticals, new relationships, you know, building from the ground up. And that is something that really, when I stepped back into corporate, I carried with me that shift in mindset. And when I stepped into leading and training and coaching other teams, I shifted my approach in teaching entrepreneurship and teaching that a self-accountability, self-motivation, and sense of ownership in a business to help to drive performance. And so that is the work that I started doing really as of like the last 5 years.
Yeah, well, I'm going to date myself a little bit. So I was born in 1976. So think of me as I like to describe it, I'm basically a millennial. I just got there a couple years later. And I'm what has been defined as essentially a cusper. I'm right on the bottom edge of Gen X as we move into millennial. And another way I describe it is I got my email in college instead of high school. So, but the experience overall was relatively similar, and people of my age and when we go into millennials and such, we began to see a culture shift that became more apparent to me in retrospect, is that the old command and control structure that we would see in companies that to me led to a certain level of toxicity was still very much in power, but it was beginning to see its end. And I believe that what has helped to accelerate that is that we are the first generation that had consistent access to high-speed internet on reliable machines at a point where search engines became very well-versed with a lot of valuable data, and the technology emerged for online communities to emerge where we could gain support. This is something not been available to those who came before us. Mm-hmm. And that gave us a framework to be able to ask the questions that we didn't even know that there were questions about, to seek different answers. So when I hear this stuff about these lazy millennials, like, please, 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 no more of the trope. I mean, go to tvtropes.com if you want a trope. But and see, I'm talking like a millennial. I'm using these types of early internet references. So but the point being is I know a lot of millennials. I don't know any lazy millennials personally. I know that people who work in companies and people who own companies, people who start companies, you have the same mix of motivation, lack of motivation, focus, lack of focus, because that's a human condition. But as far as laziness, I don't see a lot of that. What I simply see are folks who want to feel that the work that they do makes a difference. They want to feel that the time that they spend in that office or assigned to that client or in the employment of that company is something that makes them feel like they're creating value, that they're doing stuff that's going to make the company, the business, the world a better place. And they simply are looking for the opportunity to express that and have the chance to have their views seen at the table. Absolutely. And that's where I think this entrepreneur thing becomes an interesting way to put a word on that.
Yeah, I think where my perspective on it also, the way that I sort of arrived at this sense of like accountability and ownership in a business is also because of my background in tech. You know, there's the allure of working in tech because, yes, the salaries are higher. The work culture is unconventional, right? And You're not wearing a suit and tie. You can bring your dog to work. You know, you used to get free lunches before the pandemic and all this jazz, Right? And part of the way that they also incentivize tech workers is to offer them equity in the company. And so I came to terms with the fact, you know, as I developed my financial literacy and my own confidence as a professional, I came to terms with the fact that, like, y'all are literally giving me ownership in this company, which means that I'm a boss here. And what happens when you start showing up like a boss instead of an intern, right? You start to speak up. You start to hold yourself accountable. You start to project manage and negotiate and communicate on a much different level when you know that the more effort you put in and the more effort that's invested in that sort of culture, the more value you're bringing to shareholders and the more value you're bringing to yourself as an owner in the business. So there's that direct correlation between, you know, that sort of output and the gain. And that was something that I wasn't really taught as someone who was first generation, grew up in poverty. And yeah, certainly when I first started in tech, didn't provide any sort of financial literacy or anything around that. And so that's an important sort of component around, you know, how I developed this sort of fluency around entrepreneurship.
Yeah. And to me, it's just about the idea of a way to counter the whole command and control structure. I mean, the first company I worked for was actually so bad that I celebrate the day that I was fired as my second birthday, April 27th. And the reason is because it felt like a rebirth, because I discovered two things that turned out to not be the case, that I've been told all my years growing up, that if you leave a job without having another job lined up, that's essentially the end of your career. And if you get fired from a job, you better wonder if you're ever going to get another job again, because everybody's going to know. And I found out very quickly that neither of those things in the real world are actually the case.
Yeah. Yeah. Those things don't matter anymore. And, you know, it used to be that you would stay with the company 5, 10, 15 years or just through retirement. And now, you know, the average sort of tenure of a tech worker, for example, is 18 months with the company, and no one frowns around, you know, someone moving around. It's actually expected that, you know, there is this sort of cross-pollination that happens so that businesses don't grow stale in their thinking.
Well, here's another insight. So after I got fired from that job, it was, as I said, April 27th, I quickly got a temp assignment. And I was not able to complete the temp assignment. In fact, they let me go from it. The reason being is I was getting so many interviews that I could not guarantee that I could be there. Because the nature of being a temporary worker, particularly in office environments, is that you get reasonable flexibility to go to interviews for full-time jobs. But they weren't counting on me having an interview with a potential full-time employer literally every single day of the week, sometimes twice in one day. So for this temp assignment, I was pretty much just showing up and doing like 2 hours worth of work. So I ended up getting a permanent job that lasted 6 days. And by mutual agreement, me and the owner of that company just kind of agreed to sort of pretend it never happened, because we both recognized very quickly it was just a really bad fit and I didn't belong there. And I respect her for that. So at this point, we're getting up to Memorial Day. And I figure, you know, I have been driven and busting my ass my entire life. In the fall, I'm going to go get my MBA. In fact, I had already applied and had been accepted to Duquesne University in Pittsburgh and accepted the invitation. So I knew beginning September I was going for my MBA. So what do I got? June, July, August. I'm going to go pick up some manual labor jobs, make some cash. And I'm going to have some fun with my life, because damn it, I deserve it. You know, the funny thing is, within the context of an employment situation, nobody ever made any assumption about that. And I didn't even dress up my resume. I just left the gap there. No one ever questioned it, because we were already seeing a change away from those two tropes that I described earlier. Now, fast forward to 2003, after I complete the MBA, and I'm doing my usual get your MBA level job interviewing and networking. And, you know, in the meantime, I also started a side hustle that ultimately evolved into my full-time entrepreneurial venture. But I was speaking with somebody one day, a friend of mine, and, he said, you know, not for nothing, but you got that job that you've had when you first started the MBA. And I said, yep, March 2001. He said, well, it's June 2003. How much longer are you going to sit there? Like, what do you mean? It's like, you've been there 2.5 years. You've got your MBA. You sit there much longer. And prospective employers, even clients, if you start a business, they're going to say, what, isn't this guy motivated? Doesn't he have any ambition? Isn't he on the move? Doesn't anybody want to hire him? You got to get your ass out of there, like, now. Now, it took me another 2 years to get out of there. The reason being is I did go ahead with the side hustle, and I was essentially doing it without any infusion of capital. So, you know, ox, cart, and a horse. And also because I didn't know what I didn't know, and I didn't know what questions to ask. If I had had more of a picture back then, 2 years would have been 2 months. I'd have been, see ya. And that's actually why I do what I do, because I want to help people not sit somewhere for 2 years when they could get it done in 2 months. And that's really what intrigues me about entrepreneurship. It's just this cultural driver that, and I told these stories because I just wanted to share with you, Luis, and also with our listeners, why this resonated with me so much when I saw it in the application.
Yeah. I think the wonderful thing also is, as I've stepped into businesses, either in, you know, an executive capacity or a consultant capacity, to help them develop their own entrepreneurial frameworks. I just love to see the way that the culture shifts, the way that the collaboration is elevated. I love that people feel a better sort of connection to the business and the mission and the purpose when everyone is, you know, in that sort of zone and in that sort of work ethic and mentality. And I think that, you know, part of the importance in thinking about retention, which is something that you're touching on as well, is like, you know, people don't really quit jobs. They quit leaders. They quit toxic cultures. They quit environments where they aren't seen, heard, or understood, or enabled. And so if you can get ahead of those things, and, you know, invest in your people and in helping them be better decision makers and communicators and collaborators, that helps your bottom line as a business on, you know, several folds. But I have to say, I've experienced also being in a culture, you know, and experiencing what it's like to be in a well-oiled machine and to be in the sort of best in class, sort of in work environment. And it's my desire for everyone to experience that and to make that the status quo.
I fully agree with that. And again, your millennials, your Gen Zers and all that, not lazy people at all. They just don't, and I don't see the value of the kind of structure of, well, you have to be here from 9 to 5 Monday through Friday, take your mandatory hour and your 2 15-minute breaks and always answer your phone extension on the third ring. And we're at a place where major corporations, Coca-Cola is one example that I can think of right now, are in the process of doing away with voicemail. Yeah. Even as we speak, I'm in the process of transitioning my business's phone systems to a much simpler one, partially out of optimizing costs, which is always a smart thing, but partially because other than my mom, no one ever calls.
Mm-hmm.
You know how people speak with me is they go to my website, www.schedulewithadam.com, and book themselves in without even checking with me. Because I work with people who like that level of structure. And I work best with people who appreciate that structure. So, I mean, I get things all the time coming through schedulewithadam.com. It's like, okay, I didn't know you want to speak with me. So I ended up adding a field to it that says, in a nice way, okay, so you're booking the call. What do you want?
No, I think it's important for all parties to really have that moment of qualification, right? Because you have to walk into a conversation understanding, what's the best way that you can serve that person as a business owner. And then that other person needs to feel confident that they're being heard and understood. And I think that applying that filter on the onset is a way of listening and definitely would blend to a smoother customer experience.
Absolutely. So I'm with you 100%. So what I want to do now is I want to pivot the conversation here. And in order for entrepreneurship to work, it's great that the employee goes in with the entrepreneurial spirit, but that's really only going to be effective when you have great management. So in your view, what makes a great manager and why is this important?
Yeah. Okay. So in order to really sustain a high performance culture that is also highly collaborative, where everyone is self-motivated and very much aligned with the goals and the needs of the business, you have to have really strong strategy and leadership in place. There have to be examples of entrepreneurship, celebrations of the right behaviors and the right outcomes relative to entrepreneurship. And there has to be a commitment, first and foremost, in the development of the leaders and the champions of that culture. There has to be a commitment to developing leadership, not only in their intellectual capacity and their emotional capacity. We often talk about IQ and EQ when we're assessing, the right fit, right? But then there's also this element of cultural intelligence. And that's that intelligence to be able to facilitate productive conversations with people of different backgrounds and different perspectives, and to be able to bring them all to the table and align them towards that same outcome. That's also a matter of being, really attuned to the psychological safety of those people who are on the front lines of a business, who are engaging with the public and facing customers, making sure that they're also seen, heard, and understood in those instances where there is friction in the customer interaction, because inevitably, mm-hmm. your reps are going to be up against some really terrible people and some really foul attitudes. And so, you have to be attuned to all of that and be able to help navigate and facilitate those moments and even mediate. And so there has to be that investment at the leadership level, as much as there is sort of the establishment of those expectations of your reps, right? And I think that's the critical point where most businesses aren't willing to invest. They want the silver bullet or the magic hack to just get their people being more productive and making more money. But there needs to be structural investments to make that happen.
Yeah. And tell me more about the structural investments that really intrigues me.
Yeah. So in addition to thinking about investing in leadership development and coaching, I think there also needs to be a set of tools in place to track performance, to celebrate performance. Mm-hmm. And so when I think about sales organizations in particular, things like leaderboards, competitions, looking to gamify things, even thinking about how it is that people are celebrated, how people are tapped on to be subject matter experts to lead campaigns or launches or to be the go-to person when there needs to be training. All of that, all of those sort of processes and structures and tooling, that all lends itself to that successful, sustainable, performance-driven, entrepreneurial culture that people want. And it is, you know, something that it sounds quite lofty and expensive, but it doesn't have to be. It needs to be intentional and consistent. If all you've got is Google Docs and Google Sheets, you can still make all this happen. But certainly if you're in a position to invest in software and tooling to help you with your revenue operations, then it's definitely not a bad investment to make.
Yeah, let me, a couple things in what you just said. Gamification, I think, is huge. Mm-hmm. Because think about another thing that people of our age, you know, your age and my age, were raised on: video games. So we did some of our early learning through video games. And as an adult, we go back and look at how some of these games were structured, and we're finding out that there were actually lessons embedded within those games. Yeah. Like, it looked like Pac-Man was going around the maze just eating up the pellets, but there was a lesson there. For early Nintendo adopters, playing Super Mario Brothers, there were lessons in there too. There were lessons in the game Contra, which people my age certainly remember. It was extremely popular. The boxing games, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So gamification, I think, is huge. Now, our listeners know that I sometimes use pop culture references or things that seem like they're outside of the conversation, but they make sense. And they also know that I don't get political here, but I do sometimes use social issues as a way of illustrating points. So let's look at what's happened over the past going on 4 years now, this whole thing with the bug floating around, which then led to this whole thing about people getting vaccinations. Now, this is not a debate as to whether or not they were actually vaccines or not, because I know that, believe it or not, that's a question. but I think the way that they went about encouraging people to do it actually was counterproductive. So when you think of vaccine, let's test you, Luis. What is a phrase you commonly heard in media and social media chapter to describe it?
Gosh, the vaccine, it's so far removed from my entire memory. Gosh, you just brought me back to.
Okay.
I've wiped that out from my memory. Gosh.
Well, yeah, I think a lot
controversial,
but I think a lot of people have at this point, because we've transitioned from pandemic to endemic. However, the jab. Remember that phrase, the jab? Well, here's the problem with that. In the United States alone, I'm not even counting the rest of the world, just the United States, there are an estimated 50 million people, of which I'm one, that live with varying degrees of trypanophobia, which is a fear of hypodermic injections, to the point where in more severe cases like the one I have, you can tell people they need to have their blood drawn or get a shot or something like that. And I could look at that and say, you know, this COVID, it has a 99.9993% success rate, and you want me to get this vaccine? The odds are I'm going to live, so stick that needle somewhere else, because you called it the jab and you brought out the trauma. 50 million people. But imagine if, think about what we do in video games, particularly modern video games. You have the player, and one way or another, part of the quest is, as often as not, that they either pick up something, walk through something, or grab something that causes them to power up and become more invincible in their quests. So imagine if we use instead the analogy of powering up. You pick up this power serum and you infuse it in yourself, and now you're going to be able to walk through the world taller, stronger, more powerful, more impervious to bad things that could happen to you. Do you think it's possible? Can you at least see, if not for yourself, but at least see that this could have possibly increase compliance rates?
As far as like entrepreneurship?
As far as the analogy of people getting vaccinated.
I I'm not quite sure that I fully understand the vaccination
Well,
analogy.
I'm using an analogy just to show the power of gamification.
Gotcha.
That's
Yeah,
what that
so
that's what it is. So I was suggesting taking a gamification approach to it rather than a fear-based approach. You probably would have gotten a lot of people, more people taking it. So
right.
now let's go back to work and let's look at how gamification makes learning and makes the jobs we do more fun. So project management system, for example, I have three things I recommend people consider when they choose their project management system, whether they use Monday or Teamwork or Asana or whatever. Is the number one, it serves where you are now. Very important. Number two, it serves where you think you might be in 6 months to a year, knowing that if you go through astronomical growth and a better option comes along, you just transition to it, but knowing that you'll probably hold on to it at least for the next year. But here's the third one. It's got to be fun. Because if people don't enjoy using it, they won't use it, and they'll put you in a situation where they can say, "What are you gonna do? Fire me?"
No.
So imagine that as a manager.
Yeah. So, when I think about gamification, I think about like sales performance. I'm really looking at the opportunity to work with reps and establishing like what is it that motivates them to work beyond, the 9 to 5 for the day, or to put in the extra effort, and we incentivize based on that. So we'll look at opportunities to either like stack people in terms of how many opportunities they generate for the week. Most opportunities generated for the month, you'll get an iPad. Most opportunities generated for the quarter, we'll look at a voucher for travel or something like that. What we're looking is at the opportunity to incentivize the right behaviors, that sense of motivation, self-accountability, and collaboration that yields that sort of revenue acceleration that a business is looking for. And so when we think about, in the vein of entrepreneurship, it's not really like bait and switch or cat and mouse. The idea is that you're leaning into those things that keep people happy and optimally productive, and creating the systems and the games and the way of tracking performance, to really, again, establish like the right behaviors across the team.
Here in Las Vegas, we have a company called Zappos, which most people have heard of. Now, I first heard about Zappos before I even moved to Las Vegas years and years ago when it was actually a very early adopter of online, of online sales technology and internet sales to revolutionize how people buy shoes. I had heard a story about somebody who called Zappos and ordered a pizza, and Zappos sent them a pizza. So you know what I did? I tried it. And they sent me a pizza. I'm getting to the point where I bring up Zappos in a second, but I'll bring the introductory point is when you have a great story behind it, when you have the ability to have that type of fun, you become memorable. What other, I mean, there are 100,000 probably online retailers of shoes, but how many of them are going to send you a pizza if you call and order a pizza? Maybe a couple that said, "Oh, Zappos do it, let's try it." That's probably about it. But here's what I learned when I began to study Zappos and their actual operations is I found out that they would arrange the seating in their office so that the people who so that the purchasers of the shoes, the people who deal with the manufacturers and the people wanting to have their shoes featured on Zappos online store, and the people who wrote the copy sat next to each other. So, although this isn't exactly what was going on, it's almost like you had sales and marketing sitting next to each other. And that leads to the first question, which a lot of people don't get. And this is where I want you to really clarify this for us. Sales and marketing, those are two different things. That's actually a surprise to some people, but not to us, but explain to us the difference.
The when you think about just like the order of operations within a business, first of all, there's product. You have to have something to sell. Then there's sales, right? You have to have a process and a team that's dedicated to engaging customers. operations is all about fulfilling those sales. And then you round out that business order of operations with marketing, which is they own the wheelhouse around attracting customers, owning the brand sort of voice and narrative and amplifying it so that there are more sales. And so there is a real, really strong handshake that happens between the sales and marketing team, where marketing is out there hosting events, running campaigns, producing content to generate interest in the product or services. They're bringing those leads forward to the sales team to then develop those relationships and yield sales. So that handoff is really critical. And that relationship and that definition of roles is very critical as well.
Right. So they have the purchasers sitting next to the copywriters simply so that there wasn't a whole lot of quote unquote telephone game. The copywriter could actually be on the call and they would also be sitting right next to the purchaser. So they could write the copy then and there. And if they had questions about it, the purchaser was right there. Yeah. And that purchaser could call back the manufacturer and say, our copywriter has a question. Yeah. So they were able to write. So the goal of that was to be able to write better copy faster that had higher conversion rates and could be put up and get those shoes to market a lot faster.
Yeah, Zappos is, I think, one of the best sort of case studies around customer experience and even thinking about, you know, servant leadership as well. There are lots of examples and stories that I've heard in this vein of doing things entirely unconventionally and always with a very customer-centric approach.
Okay, so with all that, and thank you for sharing that, you know, you've seen changes in how sales works. And I think a lot of that's been driven by the internet and new ways that people consume information about products, get product recommendations, receive advertising. So how does sales look different now as opposed to, say, 5 years ago or maybe 10 years ago?
Ooh, wow. That's an excellent question. There are a couple of things that have happened that shifted the way that we do sales. Of course, the pandemic completely forced all of us to adopt self-paced buying experiences and started to remove the sort of human element of the process. And then there was a full pendulum swing in the other direction that happened thereafter, where people do want assisted buying experiences, but only at very specific instances during the buying process. And so the shift in sales is that we now have a lot more data about the buying process, the sort of behaviors, the time to consideration, the time from awareness of the brand to fully converting as a customer. We now have the systems and tools in place to completely analyze that and optimize the way that we create buying experiences around that. We also started to see this emergence of video and personalized video as a way of selling. So imagine, if you will, you're going through an entirely automated process, and then at some point, a human, you know, sort of pops into the view, drops a video, looks in the camera, says your name, and welcomes you to a conversation to talk out your objections or concerns or hesitations about making an investment. And so suddenly you're able to create that personalized and humanized experience at scale. And do so in a way that removes the friction from the buying experience, because salespeople have a terrible reputation, unfortunately. You know, when we think about so many professions out there that we hail as heroes, and I think up until Aaron Brockovich came out, you know, lawyers were bad people, right? And then we saw this one hero sort of element to being a lawyer. We have yet to see a hero element to being a salesperson, and so people have an aversion to talking to people. They don't want to be pushed. They don't want to be upsold or cross-sold, and they don't want to be, you know, sold into something that isn't the right fit, right? I don't need the premium. I don't need the deluxe per se, right? And so when you can remove that sort of experience and honor that our customers are a lot more educated than they used to be before they ever start sniffing around, you know, you're going to see a lot more success. But I think that's really the crux of the change, is the pendulum went from, you know, human-centered experience to total automation, and now it's swinging back to humanization and personalization at scale.
Yeah, and when we hear humanization, we're now beginning to think of artificial intelligence and how we make artificial data and communications actually feel human. Yeah. So I'm thinking of a story right now where maybe I began a sales process by interacting with live chat, which could be a human being or could be a very sophisticated bot. I really don't know at this point because it's gotten that good. So we're about two steps into it. I have a great online chat with the company. They answer all my questions and I leave it with, I'm pretty interested, need to think about it. And then the next morning, I get an email and it's Luis Baez. and it's you with that, you know, with that very soothing, deep, resonant voice of yours, looking right into the camera, with your friendly expression. People can go to your website and see you're a good looking guy, and you're looking right into the camera and you say, "Hi, Adam. I understood that you communicated with our live chat yesterday, and wanted you to know that I am here to help you. You know, and whatever else you want to say. I mean, whatever script you use, but just the fact that a human being was pinged." And actually showed up to join the conversation is a differentiator in this day and age. And it also allows you to focus on your higher value prospects, because I was the person who went into live chat and the algorithm showed that I asked thoughtful questions, that I expressed sincere interest in possibly becoming a customer, and I tripped off other algorithmic cues that showed that I had a very high score as far as somebody likely to convert. So when you get your list of leads to follow up on, I'm up there near the top. So you know to speak with me first.
Yeah.
So it helps you close more deals as well.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, the important thing you touched on the AI piece as well. This is something that at the time of the recording of this conversation, it's still being defined, you know.
Yeah.
So how is this? Is it friend? Is it foe? How do we leverage it? What's the right way to do it ethically, etc.? But there's no denying that there is a real global critical mass against artificial intelligence and the sort of ethical use of it and the sort of misrepresentation or even the idea that people are being, you know, taken advantage of by persuasive language and things like that. And so I think the more that you can do to really validate and authenticate people's experiences, you know, beyond the assisted sort of chats and things like that, if people can make a really large investment and have a moment with another person and just make sure it's the right size, the right fit, the right color, the right timing, then you will see accelerated revenues compared to those people who lean exclusively on automation.
You know, what I used to tell people back in the day is you want to test out whether your hosting company is going to be there when you have a product launch and your site crashes because so many people hit it at the same time. Yeah. Before you invest in hosting there, test out their sales and test out their tech support. See how it makes you feel.
Mm-hmm. Certainly. Yeah, that is definitely it. Definitely making sure that there's confidence. But yeah, I think, you know, we have to honor where people are as consumers. And I always say that, you know, we get into this rhetoric around B2B sales and the B2B buyer and, you know, who's who in the zoo and lining up all the executives and how do we communicate with them and make our plea. I actually like to borrow playbooks from B2C sort of sales. And I like to think about the fact that whatever your title is, I'm still selling to a human. And whatever process, you know, the sales process might be, the decision to buy is an emotional impulse, right? Once you've lined up the facts, is the trust there? Is the confidence there to then make that investment? And so I really take a human-centered approach and I take my line of questioning a step further. So beyond, you know, going into a sales conversation and understanding what do you want? When do you want it? What have you tried? Who else are you talking to? Who needs to be involved? How long is it going to take to implement? I will then go a step further and ask the person, what's in it for you? It looks like you've been with the company for 2 years. Are you up for promotion? How can I help you shine? How can I make this be something that shines and stands out in your performance review next quarter?
Yeah.
Right. I think that deeper level of humanization of like, you're trying to do a job, you've got people to answer to just like I do, and being willing to go there and just connect human to human, that's where I've seen my success.
Agreed. So what I'd like to do is I'd like to, you know, go back to work, so to speak. And part of our conversation, we're getting near the end of it, so I want to make sure we spend time on this, is the piece of it that has to do with the toxic cultures. So entrepreneurship is great. We spoke about the qualities of a great manager. We looked at the evolution of sales, which is very important. It's the lifeblood of a business. So, and we also know that in order for the sales team to be really good, they need to have some of that entrepreneurial spirit that allows them to be creative rather than just reading off scripts. That's just the nature of things, particularly in our fast changing environment. So, I imagine you've had some experiences with great environments. You've had some experiences with toxic environments. Mm-hmm. So, however you want to answer this, what can somebody do if they have that entrepreneurial spirit? How can they progress and even thrive in a culture that's toxic to that type of energy?
Yeah, gosh, I've been there so many times throughout my career. And what I can say is that you never win alone in any situation. And those times where I wasn't getting buy-in, where people weren't giving me confidence, and I ultimately didn't feel like I was being highly respected or regarded in the room, I had to take different approaches, right? Because kicking and crying and screaming completely invalidates any intellect or any contribution to the matter. And so I have to look at alliances. Amplification is honestly one of the best strategies that have helped me get visibility in my contributions. And so if I can find in that room two people or three people that can vouch for my work, can give credibility to the impact that I've made, can call out those things that are left out from the meeting, can mention whatever it is that I've done that hasn't been, included, or it can celebrate and applaud or bring me in on projects, right? Those allies are the way that we start to move the needle, because we start to get away from, this lack of confidence in me and what it is that I'm capable of. Instead, we're focusing on the results, and we're focusing on how we accelerated the results by being a team. That is how I've been able to navigate these spaces. Find your allies. And I think, one of the unspoken sort of burdens of anyone in my position that is, first generation, of color, out gay, et cetera, we're often not welcomed in the room. We often have to, develop thicker skin or be more courageous in speaking up. I've gotten to a point in my career where I just don't even care who's right. I care about what's right. I stop being concerned with people's egos, and I start leveraging data to justify the recommendations that I make, because you can feel however you want to feel, but you can't deny the numbers. And oftentimes people are tripped up by my ability to leverage data. And so that's been honestly some of the ways that I've been able to overcome some of that toxicity is through alliance and leadership and leveraging data.
Well, it's interesting. And I think it's an unfortunate development that even with all the progress we've made in society, that what I heard between the lines, and tell me if I'm off on this, is you still feel you have some othering going on, based on your ethnic background, based on being gay and everything else. And, my friends call me a flaming heterosexual. So it took me a while to understand, what that can be like to be marginalized, to be discredited, simply because, we'll just come out and say it. There are people in the room who think you're either a sinner or a freak, and that's not the case anyway. You're just who you are. You just do things, and you live a lifestyle that aligns with your authenticity and your integrity. And why can't we respect that? Because it's, as far as me, having feelings about people who are not heterosexual, people who are not white or whatever, the way I look at it is it's all good to me. Just don't put me down for being who I am. And when people bring up diversity, I say, I love diversity. Am I in the room? As long as I'm in the room, it's all good. In fact, that's how America was ultimately designed. The idea was, they call it the melting pot for a reason, that you put in different elements, different metals, different substances, which defines as people coming from different parts of the world with different cultural contributions, and you put it through a galvanizing process, and it creates something that is superior, something that is stronger as a composite than the individual sum of its components.
Mm-hmm.
So I just wanted to say that, because that, you know, that means something to me right there. But I heard something else you said when you said you never win alone. Now, have you ever been fired before?
Well, who hasn't?
Exactly. So, and I mentioned earlier in this call, I wrote a chapter about being fired. Did you know? Now, what was what? Now, did you see it coming?
And one experience, yes, and another not at all.
Okay, so in the one where you saw it coming, what were some of the clues? Whether you realized them at the time or you realized it looking back?
Yeah, you know, it's always in the retrospect that the lesson is learned. It ultimately had nothing to do with me or my capacity or capabilities, and it had everything to do with that person's conscious biases and their desire to replace me with their own person of their own choosing.
That was my experience at that company that I was fired from. My supervisor had hired somebody else who was basically a clone of herself, and she went out of her way to promote that person over me and to make clear that I was always going to be in last place. Now, what I also saw in that situation, and also in situations when I worked for the larger company, when people were edged out, is, you know, you say you never went alone. The reason that jumped out at me is because the common theme is you start to feel alone. Suddenly, you're not invited to meetings. Suddenly, your input doesn't really matter. Suddenly, and this is funny sometimes, when they used to care that you were at your desk at exactly a certain time, they don't care anymore. And you also get that sense that people are avoiding you. They're not as friendly toward you, or they find a way to just nod when they see you in the hallway instead of engage with you. And they know they and those other people, they know they can't quite put their finger on it, but they know for some reason that your days are numbered and it's in their best interest to not be seen as standing on a sinking ship. They often can't even articulate it for themselves. That's how insidious this is. So what happens is the person who is, you know, who's being marginalized on the edge of being pushed out or fired, they're being made to feel alone. And they may be told by some career coach, yeah, well, that's them telling you they're going to fire you. Get your resume up, get some interviews going. Okay, that's well and good. But see, the counter to that, and where we can bring entrepreneurship into the picture and give people the opportunity to feel that their work makes a difference, is through not being alone, to have amplifiers, to have your allies who help you make your case.
Yeah, 1,000%. And I think the way that you make your case with people who are naysayers or who have their own sort of bigotry or whatever that might be, right? The language in business is numbers and cash. And so if you aren't bought into the psychological safety of the people in the environment and their optimal productivity, you will be, at the very least, as a capitalist, concerned with the quality of the product and the market performance. And so if there are holes in your product and services that make them, not inclusive, not accessible, and not ethically sourced or developed, et cetera, because you didn't include perspectives at the table, because the conversation was stale or everyone worked in a silo, that ultimately sinks everyone's battleship. So if you're not soon going to be mo emotionally, the emotional appeal of inclusion isn't there for you, certainly the business case will be there.
You mentioned Aaron Brockovich earlier. Now, you've seen the movie,
Certainly.
and do you remember the do you remember one of the strategies that the I believe it was the power companies were using as part of their scheme to engage in their fraud and the damage they were doing to people?
Yeah, they had them sign. I remember there was like a door-to-door campaign.
That was part of it, but within that company, they kept the departments at war with each other. And when I saw the movie the first time and I heard that phrase, that like whoa. And this was 20 years ago I saw the movie for the first time, or like pretty soon after it came out. It's like, yeah, that right there is going to obfuscate and really make it impossible to solve the problem and allow insidious things to be done essentially with impunity. Because when you have the departments at war with each other, ultimately, they're just looking out for their own best interest. If one department won't go along with your program, you just find one it will.
And that's to everyone's detriment.
Yeah, absolutely. So as we wrap up here, somebody listening to this, and I'm going to tell people where they can find you in just a second. What is something that you would recommend somebody do right now with the information we've shared and anything that they may have found inspirational or at least helpful? One action they can take right now, one thought they can have, one intention they could set.
Yeah, ooh, I think that if you walk away with nothing, please, please think about the notion of amplification and allyship. Think about that opportunity to elevate the sort of contributions and voices that are overlooked, by being that person that shares the spotlight with someone else.
Yeah, I think that has everything to do with it because that creates the platform for what we're creating. All right, so folks, you've heard Luis for almost an hour. You can see that he has got a lot of great things to say. And if you, like me, have felt a certain level of resonance with his knowledge and his ability to show you a new point of view, then I encourage you to visit his website, which is www.luisbaez.com. I'll spell it for you in case you're just listening somewhere, don't have a pad of paper. It's Luisbaez, pretty much the way you would expect it to be spelled, luisbaez.com. And you're going to find a lot of great things there. He's got a great blog. I've had a chance to scan through a little bit. You can discover more about his work. He has a sales and leadership academy that's free as of this recording. And if you're listening to this 3 years from now and he's redone the website, I guarantee you're going to find something else there that's just as good. So you can find a lot of great things. There are also resources for salespeople. If your actual interest in what our conversations today had to do with optimizing your sales. So essentially, Luis is the creator of the Revenue Rescue Plan, and he has nearly 2 decades of experience with all the things that we've spoken about. He has worked with companies like, oh my goodness, Google, Uber, Tesla. Some of the biggest companies there. He has spoken at Stanford, Berkeley, Bard. I mean, this is somebody you certainly can gather at least a few pieces of knowledge from. And if you choose to speak with Luis, just mention that you heard him on the Business Creators Radio Show. I love to know that I'm sharing the love. So again, that's www.luisbaez.com. And with that, Luis, thank you so much for being with us today. It has been an honor and believe me, an education.
Thank you so very much, Adam. I appreciate the time and the opportunity to chin wag with you and your people.
We trust you enjoyed today's episode of the Business Creators Radio Show. Check out our previous and upcoming episodes on our website at www.businesscreatorsradioshow.com. While you're there, be sure to subscribe via your favorite network so you get fresh episodes delivered straight to you. Until next time, have a great day. Take care.